Hello, welcome to Growing Wild with me, Charlotte Petts, and you are listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM online and on digital. On this month's show, we have Kate Bradbury telling us about her book, The Bumblebee Flies Anyway. We head out with a neighbourhood swift monitoring group in honour of the Swift Awareness Week, which occurred earlier this month, and find out more about this fine bird. And finally, we hear from Isabella Tree and the wonderful rewilding project up on Knepp Estate in West Sussex. But first, let's have a song and its first aid kit and Heaven Knows. But Heaven Knows. As Heaven Knows by First Aid Kit. Such a jaunty, jaunty little number. Okay, first up, we have Kate Bradbury. Kate is very passionate about organic, wildlife-friendly gardening, having written numerous articles for various publications on the subject, and has now written this delightful book called The Bumblebee Flies Anyway. It tells a story of how a long-term relationship ended for her, and she took on a new flat with a little garden, and the life that went on alongside rebuilding this derelict space. Within that, her mum got very poorly as well. She had suffered a brain hemorrhage. Just to give some context on how our conversation starts, we are in her greenhouse on her allotment, and because the illness of her mum is such a central theme, then I started by asking how she is now.
She got most of her words back. She said something really silly the other day. She called me cabbage. Like something. She'll just say, hello, cabbage. No. Oh. And then she remembers. Or she knows that she says the wrong word. Okay. And then she says the right word. Or there was this wonderful moment last year. It wasn't long after she'd come out of hospital. And we all went up and we were watching the tennis. And she really liked the wheelchair tennis, and she really wanted to tell us how much she was enjoying the wheelchair tennis, but she didn't have the words for it. And she just kept saying, they drive around in these little boats. We were like, what? Golf buggies? What are you talking about? And eventually we got there, but it was, yeah, most of the time it's cute. Mm. But
I think I read the one, sausaging.
Sausaging.
I love that, instead of gardening.
Yeah.
I need to get sausaging.
Come here and do some sausaging.
give me an overview of what the book's about. A synopsis.
Okay. The book is about, it's the story of the garden I created from ruin, which was, it was covered in decking, but then life things happened, and so then the garden became a metaphor for everything else. So it sort of starts off as being a one thing, but then ends up being about, and it sounds a bit pretentious, but it's almost about life itself. But let's stick with it's a story about my garden, which I created. I moved into a little tiny flat in Brighton in Hove, and the garden as such was covered in decking, and I took it all up and I planted a wildlife garden, and then I watched all the wildlife come back to it, and this made me very happy, and I wrote a book about it, but also about lots of other things.
Yeah, because it's really personal. It's a very personal book.
Yes.
And a lot happened.
Yes.
So you got it on the back of, it was the back of a breakup.
Yeah.
That's why you moved down, and then, you know, your mum got ill.
And then my mum got ill.
But it felt like the garden was the rock, or the thing to go back to, the thing that helped you process those things.
I mean, it was my sort of constant, and it was the one constant thing I had during that time. I mean, I've always been really obsessed with gardening. I've always done it since I was very young, and one day I'd like a bigger garden where I can just spend my days in it every day. It was my friend. I know that sounds really silly, but you know, I'd just moved to Hove. I didn't know many people. There were sort of huge amounts of time where I was just on my own, just getting on with things, and the garden was a sort of distraction from that, really. Mm. Sort of helped me channel my boredom, loneliness, despair. And it was good, and then the sparrows came and cheered me up.
Has that always been the way for you? Have you found that with gardening, being in a garden before, has it helped you through times like that previously, or did it really cement itself during this time?
I think it's quite hard to say, because gardening is so much a part of me that I don't really know how useful it is or how important it is. But then I suppose, because it's sort of the very fabric of me, that is the important thing in itself.
When did you realise it was such a big part of you? Did you have a moment of thinking, oh yeah, right, this is it, this is my thing? I did. I got an allotment on a whim,
because
I drove past one every day, and I thought it'd be fun to have a shed and eat sandwiches out of wrapped paper. I just wanted to be an old man. And I had no idea what I was doing, and I think there were some potatoes already in there, and I dug up some potatoes and thought, this is brilliant. And that was it was like, well, this is what I want to do.
I don't know, when I went to university there were plant sales and I bought lots of plants, and then everyone else who bought plants would bring me the plants because I was the only one that was able to keep my plants alive.
Okay.
And then they all took the piss out of me because I was the one that kept the plants alive, and then they made me feel really small and inadequate as a human, even though I was saving their plants. And I went travelling for a year and went to Australia and just came back with gardening books. I was like, what are you doing? And I just missed it. I missed gardening. I went, you know, I was travelling and having a really amazing time that other 20-year-olds have, and, you know, drinking beer and getting into scrapes and things like that, but also buying gardening books and reading them in my bunk beds and just sort of connecting in that way. So it's always been there. Yeah, I don't know. It's just really important. And just listening to the birds and just being out here. Sometimes I get really cross about, I don't know, emails or whatever, work things or family things or, you know, other just life things that make you cross, and then I come down into the garden or on my allotment and do some digging, listen to the birds and check on my slow worms, and then everything's all right. Or it's not all right, but it's just less bad, or it's less annoying.
One of the major themes is conservation. It's made me be more aware, having read it.
Thanks.
Definitely. So much of our wildlife is disappearing without us really noticing. So we kind of pay attention when things are going extinct, and suddenly like, oh gosh, we can't let that happen, and then there's this huge surge. But just the gradual thinning out of things seems to almost pass us by, and that's actually what's happening in a lot of situations.
Yes, and shifting baseline syndrome as well, where people hark back to their childhoods and they say, oh, there was lots of butterflies when I was a kid. But actually, if they talk to their parents and their parents hark back to their childhoods, then there were probably three times as many butterflies then. And then if they talk to their grandparents, then suddenly you have like clouds of butterflies. Everything changes in 30-year cycles.
Yeah, what we compare back to is less and less and less.
Yeah, so when I was a kid growing up in the 80s, we'd already had the worst year ever for butterflies, which was 1976, which was the year of the drought. And so I can look back at my childhood and think, oh, well, butterflies, whatever. But actually, sort of 20 years previously, there would have been a lot more.
Do you think that we don't really realise that our behaviours cause such a detrimental effect? So thinking about front gardens and how a lot of them turned into driveways, and we're just concreting everything, concrete, concrete, concrete. Or there's an annoying buddleia, we pull it out.
Yeah.
It's annoying, we don't want that there.
Yeah.
These things, we're not looking at what's living in them, what's feeding off them.
No.
Enough. And maybe we don't realise that each, or do you think that we don't realise that each little portion of land that we're doing that to is having a huge effect?
Yes, completely, I agree.
Damn, that was such a
close-ended
question.
She's kicked over a chilli.
She's kicked over my chilli, which is the first chilli flower of the year.
It's okay, don't worry, I've got loads.
I might be able to like put it with a stick. No, I agree completely. I think we're so far removed from the natural world that we don't see the other species that share the spaces we share. And we don't, we're not aware of their needs, and we don't think about them. And I think there's sort of parallels with all areas of neighbourliness and understanding. And, you know, if you look at the way we treat people from other countries and things, you know, there's an empathy there, or a lack of empathy for the needs of these people and these species. And we just sort of go on bulldozing, doing what's right for us and what we want to do, without actually thinking that other species do things differently or need different things. And so, yeah, you might have a a bit of a front drive, which you want to pave over completely so you can park both of your cars, but that just means that the hedgehog that feeds in the front gardens every night won't have anywhere to feed. You have this cumulative effect which denies food for hedgehogs, frogs, birds, and all the things they eat. Just removes habitats, and a habitat is a home, so it just removes homes for wildlife. 40 years ago there were 30 million hedgehogs, and now there's 1 million hedgehogs, and we're all culpable, unfortunately, without even knowing it. And that's the saddest thing, we don't even know what we're doing.
Fencing. Tell me, what can we do about helping our hedgehog population?
We can dig a hole under our fences on either side so that they can come in, because a hedgehog cannot exist in one garden alone. And it's a myth that they eat slugs and snails, unfortunately. They do eat a bit, but not a lot, not loads. Their main diet is beetles and caterpillars. And one garden alone can't provide all the food that they need. And they're a roaming species. They roam for like a mile a night looking for food. They're quite solitary, apart from in spring, when they like to meet up with other hedgehogs and make a lot of noise.
Just adult hedgehogs.
Yeah. Consenting adult hedgehogs. And they need space. They need space to look for food and find somewhere to nest.
After writing a book like this, what's your best case scenario that will happen? It feels like a bit of a call to arms.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I really want people to buy my book.
Other than that,
I don't know. If one person came up to me and said, I'd made them think twice about paving, decking, fake turfing their lawn, then I would consider that an achievement. I suppose it is a call to arms. I think, I don't know, it almost feels arrogant to say, oh yeah, I want to change the world and I want people to think differently and do things differently, but actually I do want them to. Birdsong, bees, butterflies, hedgehogs, frogs, slowworms, baby blue tits, like they just make us happy and they make us feel whole, or certainly make me feel whole. And I would be so depressed if I didn't have gardening and gardens in my life. And I would really like other people to appreciate how wonderful it is and just get outside and get their fingers dirty and fill their ears with birdsong, because it's really restorative.
That robin at the end was actually real. Just as she was saying, listening to birdsong, it started chirping up outside. Amazing timing. That banging, by the way, that you could hear every now and again was the glass, where it was quite rainy and a bit windy. You know, back in the days when it rained, it was doing that. And yeah, so you can just hear it. I also quite love how I just said, do you think we notice what a detrimental effect we're having? Or maybe we don't notice. And then I kicked over a chili, which was bad times. It really is. It's such a great book, and her experience that she was going through, kind of working through her breakup and then her mum getting so ill, and then the passion that came with just wanting to transform this space, and the energy that she could transfer into doing that through her grief and upset, and the moments of joy that you experience when a little house sparrow comes in for the first time and starts feeding from your garden, or starts living in something in your garden. And it's those little moments that we all hang on to, and she just encapsulates that really well. So I highly recommend it. She is going on a book tour. You can find out where if you follow her on Twitter at Kate_Bradbury, then there's more details on there. Okay, let's have a song, and then next up we're going to find out more about Swifts. But first we're going to have Joni Mitchell and Big Yellow Taxi.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
A parking lot.
Creepiest laugh in any song, right? Great song though. Brilliant song. Love Joni Mitchell. Okay, next up we have Swifts. It was recently Swift Awareness Week, which highlighted, unfortunately, the horrible fact of the huge decline in numbers in the last two decades. The numbers are down a whopping 51%. They have halved in 20 years. If you're not too sure which birds the swifts are, they are the sickle-shaped birds that you see screeching through the sky at this time of year. They're only here for about 12 weeks, and they never land, and they fly. They seem to just clang into a building and disappear, where they actually just nip in to the eaves of our roofs. They only come here to nest and spawn their young, and like I say, they find spaces in the eaves or small gaps in the tops of our roofs. But unfortunately, because of our vigour for loft conversions and better insulation in our roofs, the nest sites are rapidly disappearing without us really realising that that's what's happening, that that's what we're doing. So that and the huge decline of airborne insects, which is their sole diet, these little birdies are really struggling. So thankfully, there are groups like this. The RSPB have several volunteer swift groups monitoring numbers and educating neighbourhoods as to how they can help. So here are Rebecca, Catherine and Jeeva from the Hanover Swift Monitoring Group to tell us more.
I'm Rebecca. I'm a volunteer urban swift advisor, which is a sort of fancy title for someone who goes around my own neighbourhood looking out for swifts. I go out monitoring swifts for 12 weeks that they're here, which is a really short time. It's a shorter time actually for any birds that come to visit us. We try to monitor them as well as we can for the 12 weeks they're here.
When are they here from?
Here from May and for 3 months.
Okay.
So they're usually the last birds to turn up, even though they're one of the birds that come the furthest. Our swifts come from the Congo Basin, so they have a pretty long road. They come later than swallows and other birds, so they have to get on with it pretty quickly and get their juveniles fledged and off again and back to the Congo 12 weeks later. So we have a really short time frame to monitor them. Brighton being a real hotspot for swifts, and that's why the RSPB really promote the work that people like us do and increasing their volunteer base so that we can both monitor where swifts are so we can try and protect their sites, and we can also encourage people locally to make some small adjustments to their properties, for example, to protect swifts. A key factor that we can influence in the UK is trying to protect nest sites and also encouraging swifts to nest in swift nest boxes, and that's a key part of what we do and what we're doing out tonight. Swifts can't just go and make another cut, like another nest. They're incredibly loyal to their nest site, and will try and endeavour to get back in there, even bashing their heads where the hole was, to try and break through to that nest site. You can move a nest site slightly, and again, you can't be guaranteed that you'll get the swift. So that's why it's so important that we create new nesting opportunities for swifts. And what we're doing out tonight, if we get to talk to people, we'll be talking to them about putting swift nest boxes up. They're incredibly efficient, incredibly inexpensive, anything from around £16. And they're something that we know works. So that's a key thing that we do, particularly when people have scaffolding ups. Again, this time of year, we have to work quickly to contact people, to talk to them, to say, look, you've got scaffolding up. This is a fantastic opportunity. Get online, get yourself a swift nest box and get it up. And obviously, we are here to guide people and help them with any ideas about where's the best place to put swift boxes. Importantly, and the thing I feel really passionately about, is that we are talking to our neighbours. We're walking about the streets, people come up to us, they ask us all sorts of questions, and it's great engaging with people locally and encouraging them to go to our website and to look up swifts, because they are absolutely incredible animals.
Okay, well, let's have a we've got a route, you've got a designated area, so why don't we have a stroll around and see if we can see anything.
We will see some probably in the next 10 minutes.
So you see there, it looks like they've left that uncut for the benefit of insects and wildlife.
They have.
Road that we had low flying swifts, of two low flying swifts, like street level.
Well, that's low flying party, isn't it? How many was it?
There were two at street level that were practically skimming the ground.
So my name's Catherine. This is my first year as a volunteer with the RSPB. It's something really I've always wanted to do since I was a kid. Been fascinated by birds, always spending time in my garden working out what the different types of species they are, and it's something that's kept with me my whole sort of up until sort of being an adult. So always wanted to be either volunteer or work for the RSPB, and now that I'm in Brighton, where there's quite a big sense of community, I went on the website and came across this opportunity with supporting the local swift. So it's been absolutely fantastic and really enjoying it.
What have you learned from doing it?
So I've learned, obviously, I mean, when I first looked on the website, going particularly looking for work specifically for swifts wasn't necessarily something I was looking for, but as a result, I've just learned a huge amount about the type of bird they are, almost the characteristics, almost like their personality. And working with Rebecca and Jeeva, it's been really fascinating just to learn about not just the birds, but the different types of birds. When you're walking around and they've got all these facts about other species, and the biggest thing I've learned really is how supportive all the community are and how interested they all are in learning more and what they can do to support them. And when you start talking about the different putting up bird boxes, etc., their eyes light up. So it's been fantastic from that point of view.
Would people even know that they were nesting in the roof if they didn't know? You know, can you hear them? Are they noisy?
I mean, they are quite noisy people. One of the biggest things, you can hear them, they've got that sort of characteristic sort of screech as they're sort of flying in, but they're very clean birds. Mm. So it's sort of in comparison to starlings, for example, who are quite messy birds, they're so clean that you wouldn't necessarily even know that they existed, which is one of the difficulties as well. So you may not know. And I have to say, even from my own perspective and being a bird lover myself, I don't look up into the eaves and have a look underneath the guttering and the fascias of houses and look for swift boxes, but I do obviously now. And even from just speaking to a few people, friends, etc., they're all saying, oh, my landlord's got scaffolding up and I'll help out in any way I can. So, and then when you talk about them in swifts, and they do know the type of bird, it's just they don't know a huge amount about them. So yeah, it's been fantastic.
Quite often there'll be like a group of maybe up to sort of 15, 16 swifts, I think we've counted in the past.
Cool. That's a lovely number up there.
Yeah, there's quite a few. They come and go. It's almost like they just appear and reappear. But that must be 2, 4, 6, 8. See, they've disappeared again. I've just counted about 12 just now, and then there's 6.
My name is Jeeva. This is my first year volunteering. I've always loved birds ever since I was really, really young. Been an RSPB member, interested in conservation ever since I can remember, really. But this is my first year of volunteering with swifts. I did toads last year.
Oh, did you?
I did toad rescue.
So what brought you to swifts?
To swifts. I was doing the online survey last year, and then I was interested in getting a swift nest box put up on my house. And I emailed the local RSPB office saying, can you recommend a builder who can do this? I wasn't keen on going up on a ladder myself.
Sure.
And it all just developed from there, really. They said, would you be interested in surveying? And I thought, yeah, I reckon I can manage that. And I'm really enjoying it. It's actually quite a lot of fun to just walk around the neighbourhood looking, you know, with a lovely little team. It's great. Really enjoying.
Do you feel like you've increased your own knowledge?
Yeah, I've definitely learned more about swifts and, yeah, a bit more about the neighbourhood as well. Mm. Talked to a few people. Yeah.
See, those holes, those ventilation holes, the RSPB is suggesting people can take those plugs out and then the swifts can just get in there.
Oh, right.
And I went in and had a chat with them. I'd been putting it off, thinking, oh, how do I start this conversation? But they're actually really receptive. The receptionist was really nice.
So that's 3 low-flying, do you think?
So this is Scotland Street. Three?
If people want to get involved or you've piqued their interest, what can people do? How can we help?
That's a great question. People can help on any level, really, as little or as much involvement as they want to get into. Their swifts are going to be around for about another month. They leave around the end of July. So really, keep an eye out for them. Enjoy them, first of all. Enjoy swifts. Have a look out for them. If you see them, quite near to where you live or low flying, you can go onto our website and you can record where they are. So that's immediately, that's a really easy thing to do, and that's a great way to contribute to the monitoring of swifts in Brighton Hove. That's absolutely brilliant, and all across wherever you live. You can go onto the national website. You can also try and help make your home a little bit more swift friendly and find out if you're in a swift area, put up a nest box, talk to people about swifts, get the conversation going, talk to your neighbours and so on. And if you wanted to go further, of course, you could volunteer. The three of us, we come out once every 2 weeks, just for the 12-week period, a couple of hours in the evening. It's a really sociable way to get to know your neighbourhood and other people who have passion like you. So there is any level of contribution. Each one of them has enormous amount of value and contributes towards the protection of swifts. There, did you see a swift there?
Brilliant.
Yeah.
They really are a fantastic species of bird. They're so interesting because they never land. So they sleep whilst flying. They just snooze one side of their brain at a time. And for the first 3 years of their life, they actually never land because they don't start nesting until they're older. And even when they are nesting, which is only for a short amount of time, because they're so active, they do press-ups with their wings the whole time until they can fly again. So interesting. If you want to find out more about the swifts, then go to the RSPB website. I'll put links to that on the show page, which is radioreverb.com, and then search for shows and then find Growing Wild. One of the key things to take away from that is if you are having work done on your roof or you're getting your loft done, then just check for nests. And if you see one, then whilst the scaffolding's up, or even if you don't see one, whilst the scaffolding's up, just put a little swift box up. It's dead easy. They look very sweet. In fact, you wouldn't notice unless you were actively looking for them, because I certainly hadn't. And there's actually, you know, there's a few scattered around in the area that we were in Brighton, which was very heartening, actually, to see that. Yeah, we've all got to play our part. We've got to do something, because that decline in numbers is just shocking and awful. Yeah, we can all help. Okay, let's have a song. And then we're going to hear from Isabella Tree of the Knepp Estate. But first, we're going to have Ask by the Smiths.
Nature is a language, can't you read? Nature is a language, can't you read? So
as Ask by the Smiths. You're listening to Growing Wild on Radio Reverb, and I am Charlotte Petz. Okay, next we have Isabella Tree. Her and her husband own Knepp Estate, which is just out in West Sussex. It's a 3,500-acre piece of land, and they have pioneered a rewilding project there, enabling the reintroduction and re-emergence of many of our native British species of wildlife. So I went and had a chat with her in her library, in her castle. We're on these leather chairs, so you can hear some squeaking sometimes, and that's the leather of the chairs. So here's us having a little chat and her telling us more about the project that they've undertaken and the work that they've done on the estate.
Knepp used to be an intensive arable and dairy farm. So we're about 3,500 acres, and we are 44 miles from central London and surrounded by big roads and underneath the Gatwick stacking system, and it was a very, very different place 20 years ago. So when we inherited it, we just simply carried on doing what Charlie's grandparents had done for decades, which was farm every available inch of land. And we assumed, we inherited the farm, it was already losing money in the 1980s, and we assumed, rather arrogantly, I suppose, that it was Charlie's grandparents' problem, you know, that they had not invested, they weren't up with the latest technologies, and we thought we could make a go of it. So for 17 years, we just tried to be the best farmers we could be. And we invested in bigger machinery, in infrastructure, we made, you know, amalgamated dairies, we made efficiencies, we put more pesticides on the land, more nitrogen, more fertilizer, more chemicals, and after 17 years, we still couldn't make ends meet. We had a massive overdraft and it was getting larger and larger by the minute. Mm. Because when you're on heavy Sussex clay like us, you just cannot compete with modern intensive farming. And that was the key. So eventually, after 17 years, we realised we had to give up. We had to do something dramatically different. And we sold the dairy herds and we sold the farm machinery and we made 9 people redundant. And it was a really, really black day. Mm. But we wanted to do something with the land rather than battling against it all the time. Mm. We realised we had to do something radically different. And so we started exploring how we could turn the whole estate back to nature, using free-roaming animals to drive the system, to recreate habitat, to recreate biodiversity.
Is that something you'd seen happen before? I mean, it's not an idea that necessarily would come to everybody as a solution. You know, it's so radically different. Had you seen it happen somewhere else? Or
we had, but just about the time when we were hitting the buffers, so around the late 1990s, and we actually sold the farm machinery and all the animals in 2000, we came across this man called Frans Vere, a Dutch ecologist, brilliant, brilliant man, who had just published in 2000 in English his book Grazing Ecology and Forest History. Not a light read, but it is absolutely astonishing what he's saying. And we were really, really intrigued by it, because what he's saying is that we'd completely forgotten about all the animals that would have been grazing our landscape before human impact. So we've forgotten about the herds of bison, of aurochs, of tarpan, of elk, of wild boar, beavers by the million. All these animals would have been in our landscape, interacting with our vegetation. They'd have been driving a much more open, much more complex system. Mm. And we've just completely forgotten about them. So what Frans is saying is that if you reintroduce some of these animals, these heavy-hitting herbivores, into a landscape, they can inject dynamism into that landscape again. They can start generating different habitats, and they're rocket fuel for biodiversity. They kind of create the messy margins where most of life thrives. So if you allow this to happen, if you introduce these animals, and then the key thing is to sit back and let them do the work for you. So not to micromanage, not to try and hang on and keep habitats static or preserve for one particular species. If you just let these animals have free rein and let them disturb and muddy the water, literally puddling around the edges, if you let them trash the vegetation, trample, rootle, you know, do their thing, then extraordinary opportunities open up for other life. And so we thought, this is so exciting. Let's see. Let's do an experiment and see if it works.
Mm. How did you think you'd make? I mean, it's a horrible way to have to look at things, but we all have to make money. How did you see that you could make money from doing that?
Well, just stopping farming was like stopping the hemorrhage. I mean,
really,
we cleared our overdraft by selling the animals and by selling our milk quota. But now, really, what's happened is we still get a subsidy from the EU in the form of higher level stewardship, which is a kind of agri-environment subsidy, and we're very pleased to get it, but we are planning for it disappearing. Who knows what will happen post-Brexit? We hope that there'll be some form of recognition for the other services that we provide, because we're providing all sorts of benefits for the public, like flood mitigation, water purification, air purification, carbon sequestration, soil restoration, all these things that we're really desperately in need of.
Yeah.
So we hope there'll be some recognition for that, but we are planning to be self-sustaining. So at the moment, our income comes from the meat that we sell, because we cull the animals, so we keep them to very low stocking levels so that they can interact with vegetation and still get this dynamism in the landscape, so no overgrazing. And that's 75 tonnes of beautiful, organic, premium, free-roaming, self-medicating meat, I mean, the most ethical you could buy. Mm. So we get a premium for that. That brings in about 120,000 a year. So already,
yeah,
we're way ahead of the game compared to what we were like when we were farming. And then we have a tourism business, so we have safaris and glamping and camping. And that brings in another really important income stream. We've got so much wildlife now that people really want to see it. And we suddenly thought, well, why travel to the ends of the earth to see exotic, exciting wildlife when you could have it on your doorstep and actually see what British wildlife is like?
Yeah. Have you faced any opposition? Or I get a sense that maybe there's some suspicion around what you've done. And it's quite interesting because it may not have been how the land was exactly back in... Because that's the term with rewilding, right? It sounds like we're trying to do something that's returning it to as it was, and I'm not sure that's quite accurate. But in terms of putting the land back or allowing it to be free, it feels like it's free. And it was us that meddled with that in the first place by making it very agricultural, and maybe there was a level amount of suspicion around doing that initially, as there seems to be now in reversing it. It's quite interesting. So have you come across that, you know, from other farmers?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, when we first started, we had opposition from all angles.
Right.
And it is a difficult concept to get your head around, I think. It's very uncomfortable. Because rewilding itself is unpredictable. We don't know where it might take us. It's letting go of the steering wheel. It's allowing nature to take over. And nature is messy and chaotic, and there's boom and bust cycles involved, which people often feel very uncomfortable with, and we did to begin with. And I think it's really important to emphasise that, you know, it's unfortunate that rewilding has that little wee bit in front of it, because people do, as you say, assume that you're going to be trying to recreate the past. But we know we can't do that. Our world is so changed, and we've changed it, you know, for better or usually for worse, environmentally. But also we don't have any of the animals that were here 10,000 years ago. I mean, we don't have many of them. So the aurochs, the tarpan, are extinct. So what we can do, though, is we can do something interesting with the tools that we got left to us. So we can use domesticated versions of the aurochs. We can use the old English longhorn, which is what we have here, or Exmoor ponies can stand in for the tarpan. Our Tamworth pigs stand in for wild boar. They still have the same gut flora, the same disturbing mechanisms, the same vegetation preferences. So they are still providing some interesting interaction with vegetation that is really, really useful. So all you're trying to do is just make something that is more biodiverse, more exciting than was already here. Before you start having all your lovely headline species, your nightingales, your turtle doves, your purple emperors coming back, there's a transition period when what you're seeing is ragwort, creeping thistle, the pioneer species coming in. And if you're looking over your hedge, your garden fence, at what had been a very orderly managed, you know, landscape, it's kind of like our idyll we have in our... We've grown up within our heads that the British landscape is orderly and manicured. Mm. And if you suddenly see the whole thing turning into thorny scrub, you think, what on earth is going on?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it is about aesthetics and learning to change the way we look at things and the way we think of things as beautiful or not, and that actually there is beauty in exuberant scrub that's heaving with birds. And so slowly I think the opposition, particularly amongst our neighbours who saw this transition happening very quickly, has begun to simmer down, because I think they see the results, the wildlife that's coming back.
It must feel like you're doing something really good.
Well, when you know, just last night, was it the night before last, we went for a walk just along one of the old water meadows, and you're hearing nightingales, you're hearing turtle doves. I mean, turtle doves are about to go extinct in the UK, and we are the only place probably in the UK where turtle dove numbers are actually rising. We know we had no turtle doves while we were farming, and now we had 16 singing males last year. So, it's astonishing.
Yeah.
Every week there's some extraordinary, new arrival. We don't introduce anything. They've all just found us. So last week we had a pair of goshawks in the southern block, which is astonishing. And a pair of them, they might be nesting somewhere. Who knows?
Yeah.
We had great white egrets a couple of weeks ago. And, there's just lesser spotted woodpeckers. A pair of peregrines nesting in a tree. It's almost unheard of.
Yeah.
So it is really thrilling. And we must be doing something right, is all I can say.
Did you have an intention of it being so big, such an example? Could you ever have dreamt of where it started and now where you are now?
Had absolutely no idea. And I don't think we have an advisory board of 20 sort of specialists. They're ecologists, and some of them are involved in Natural England, so they're kind of government advisors. And we had absolutely no idea, any of us, that it would become such an important project, and that we would have people flooding here to see it. I mean, it's been amazing. All we wanted to do was an experiment to see if it would work, and also to change our fortunes and to somehow make this land sustainable again for the future. But it's turned out to be so much more exciting than that. And the people who walk through the door every day of the week is amazing. The specialist, the dung beetle specialist, the purple emperor, the aficionado, you name it. You just get these extraordinary people who are just thrilled and excited by what's happening here.
Yeah. So what do you see happening next? What's your hope for the future?
Well, the wonderful thing about rewilding is you have no goals, you have no targets, so we have no idea what will happen next. All we hope is that there'll be more extraordinary species finding us, and we that seems to be the case. But also that people, and perhaps government too, will be inspired by what's happening at NEP to use it as a way to roll out the sort of idea. This is Sir John Lawton's idea. He did the paper on the future of nature in Britain, to make bigger, better, joined up places for nature in Britain. So I think rewilding like we've done here can provide the sort of webbing that can allow the sort of the corridors, the stepping stones for wildlife throughout the landscape. So not just on marginal land, but even on intensively farmed huge areas of arable. We need wildlife. I think we need all of us to feel that there are these wild places out there, and to experience, birds in our skies again. So to have these ribbons of nature running through all our wildlife would be fantastic in the future. And I think it's crucial as well that we have a way of restoring soil. So I think to regard rewilding as an ally of farming, not just not as an enemy at all, but its natural ally. So it's a way of restoring soil. The National Farmers Union announced just a few years ago that we only have 100 harvests left in the UK before we have no soil at all in which to grow anything. So how do we get that soil back? And rewilding, I think, is an extraordinary way of, within a generation, getting life and structure and our microbes and everything back into the soil to make it viable again.
Just overcoming the fear bump.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it, yeah.
I could have spoken to her all day. It's lovely to hear that there's a project like that exists after hearing the first two pieces, where it's all kind of worry and declining in numbers, to go to a place like NEP and see it thriving and filling up with species that are otherwise almost extinct. I mean, I was there the other day and saw purple emperor butterflies, which is that are now super rare, and they've got a record number there in excess of 300, which I know is still such a tiny amount, but in comparison to how many there are around, then that's really quite something. The fact that the government have taken interest in it, the National Trust, the Sussex Wildlife Trust, are all looking at it as a blueprint, as a viable option that we can start looking at to return land to just being healthy again. But I know the difference for them is the fact that they own the land, and that is a big difference, because if you're a tenant farmer, then you are operating under a different rule set, really. Isabella has written a book about their experience, and it's called Wilding, which I'd really recommend if you'd like to find out more about the project. You can go and camp there, you can go on safaris and be able to experience some of the wildlife there for yourself. Okay, let's have a song, and it's going to be Awake My Soul by Mumford & Sons. Is Awake My Soul by Mumford & Sons. Okay, I've come to the end of the show, so I just need to say thank you to everybody that took part this month. You can find out more about everybody that featured on the Growing Wild show page if you head to radioreverb.com. There will be links up there. If you want to get in touch, then I am on Instagram and Twitter at growingwildfm. You can email growingwildreverb@gmail.com or go through the show page on the website that I just mentioned. Thank you very much for listening. So until next time, go well.